Today is Thursday. It is April 11th, 2019. It's 11:12 in the morning. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record in the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. Listen for me weekdays on that radio station from 1 to 3.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio and do the news with John.
I'm Justin Kaufman. I host Extension 720 and also Lower Wacker Live podcast.
I'm Patty Vasquez, and I host evenings here Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. unless it's a game of some sort, in which case I'm on a little bit later.
And it is so nice to hear Extension 720 back. I was listening
yes!
this week.
Yeah, right?
Opening with some Milt Rosenberg and then moving into it.
Yeah, no kidding. That's your new home on the radio. I think two things are great about that. You being on the radio whenever in the evening, great. And the Extension 720 brand, I think, means a lot to a lot of people.
It's amazing. It's an honor to be a part of it and to try and do well by Milt's legacy and also the listeners at night. So it's great to really be part of it.
And we've been able to do crosstalk
yes,
again.
Yes, and Patty and I are back on the crosstalk
train. Yeah, we get to see each other.
Well, that's right. You guys intersect in the evening and you get
yes.
a chance to visit.
We did that for years. And then, I moved to the morning, so it's nice to come back. It's good to see a familiar face, right?
Exactly.
It's always nice to find a job where you only work 2 or 3 days a week,
too. Oh, it's really nice.
Wow.
I think all of us hate that, where they go, are you only on the air a few hours? That's a good job.
He's here now, though, and leaves at 11 o'clock
at night.
Well, look at you.
He
you come in for this podcast. It's in the morning. You're on in the evening. By the way, our friends from the Chicago Tribune, editorial cartoonist Scott Standis and columnist Eric Zorn are not here. They couldn't join us today. Missing Eric's grandiose self-introduction.
I thought about it for a second. I just got off the phone with my husband, and I was telling him how bad I am at blowing my own horn. Or is it tooting my own horn? Blowing?
Tooting, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. Something like that.
You both.
But by the way, them not being here is why I made sure I got here on time. I was like, it's going to be much more obvious if I'm late.
There are three long-term things I'm going to bring up to Thomas Jefferson when he comes to town for our two-man show May 18th at the Classic Cinemas Tivoli Theater. Illinois wants to legalize pot, sports betting, and a graduated income tax. I think pot and gambling are likely going to happen. The tax the rich thing requires a constitutional amendment. That'll take some time. In principle, I'm okay with all three, but all three make me nervous. I don't like the word fair to sell a tax, however. Would the three of you green light all three concepts?
Well, I think, first of all, we should do pot before gambling because that will increase the gambling revenue.
right.
Yes.
And I think a graduated income tax is probably a fairer. Why is fair?
Because fair makes it sound like people who make more than $250,000 are getting away with something.
Well,
that they're not paying their fair share.
People who make $20,000 are paying a much bigger chunk of their money than people who make $250,000.
I don't think taxes should come without limits. At some point, you ought to say, you know what? You've only used so many fire departments. You've only driven on so many roads. At some point, if I were king, you would hit a tax ceiling.
Well,
but I don't think I have an obligation.
We do that with Social Security, right?
It's kind of like that, right?
I also think that people who make more money are better equipped to be able to keep more of their money than people who make less. It's this strange sort of thing. The more you have, the more you get to keep.
Listen, having said all of that, I'll also offer this. People who have billions and billions of dollars, that's obscene, right? There's something about that also bugs the hell out of me.
When is enough enough?
I know. And it's just wrong. It's like every dollar bill is a little boat of prosperity that other people would benefit more from having. And you've got it on a dock and nobody's on that boat.
I would like to talk politically because the idea of cracking open state constitutions has been thrown out for 20, 30 years, and they've never been able to politically do it. They have a Democrat governor and a Democrat state house. They think they can get it done. You have to have 3/5 of both chambers to do that. That's why we're seeing a full-on marketing blitz before they even attempt to do this, because they can't do it for, 18 months or something?
Yeah.
There's a number until they can actually open it. So they're going to be spending a lot of money on TV ads and other places to try to convince everybody that this is a good
idea.
Well,
once it's pried open, you want to keep it open, though, don't you?
You have to.
You've got other things you want to change.
And we were talking to David Greising from BGA about that this week. Do you do that? Do you go in there and change the
Constitution?
The pension
stuff?
Yep.
That's a big if.
What's
and will
so
that change people saying, I want this to be open? I'm going to vote for this to be open.
What's so sacred about the Constitution?
It's just that the idea, there's two big things in there. One, how we do taxes. And I don't think there's a lot of pushback about changing how we do a flat tax or a graduated income tax. There might be questions about whether or not you like that or you don't like that or from one side of the aisle or another. With pensions, though, that is the I guess, the fabric, the backbone of what we have run into, this idea of if we promise you something, you get it. It's in the Constitution. And going in there and changing it is very weaselly to me. It's very, really, I think it is.
But it depends on how they change it. They could change, they could guarantee the people who already were given those right. promises, guarantee those benefits, but then for the future change them under the Constitution.
They could do that now. They could do that.
But not under the Constitution, can they?
I believe you can, because right now, all it says in the state Constitution is if you offer a certain deal, you have to respect that deal. Meaning if I'm getting a pension and this is the terms of that pension,
right.
that's the deal. They have already started to switch on that. If you talk to down there.
Cullerton did something like that,
they're,
right?
Yeah, they're moving
right.
to a more 401k-like feel. You can do that. For anyone starting new, it's different than if you started in 1985.
But those obligations are massive, and that's really what I think this is
very
about.
Very much so.
And I think they want to ungrandfather those
people.
I don't think Madigan would.
No way. That
wouldn't happen.
Then what's your concern here?
Well, I'm sure the unions will be very concerned that they would try to do that.
Yeah, I think that there's a concern, I think, for the unions, but I also think there's a concern that this is just a red herring, or not a red herring, but a wolf in sheep's clothing, where you're going in to change the taxes. But there's a couple other things while I'm in there I'm going to go ahead and fix.
And that might be one way the Democrats win the Republicans over, because I know the Republicans want to go in there and change the way we structure pensions and the promises that we make.
I think a lot of people want those pensions restructured who aren't getting those pensions because they think that was a fool's deal. That
you're talking about
it's
a
wrong,
lot of different
things. And we can't honor it.
It's wrong.
What's wrong?
It's wrong to make a commitment to someone and then take it back.
I agree. Well, and I don't think it's fool's gold. I think that we mismanaged it.
Exactly.
I think we had bad managers from Governor Edgar to Mayor Daley down the line.
And Thompson, too.
Yeah, who said, you know, we don't have to pay for this right now. We're not going to be around in the year 2000. Yeah.
I agree. It's out of control. It needs to be changed. But I'm also saying it's not right to work under promise and then 20 years later have it.
Do you know people who have worked, who are benefiting from those pensions, who worked for a while, they retired in their 50s, they're getting a lot of money, maybe they've got another job, it just seems to be so good for them.
Because they stayed at a job for 30 years and
25.
Right. And there was a promise that was made. But here's the thing is that, you know, again, as we're talking about, it was the mismanagement. They used the pensions as a credit card. So the pension problem that we have isn't necessarily a function of the Constitution as much as it was mismanagement.
Here's what I would do, and I would do this with military pensions too, and I know it will never happen, where you qualify for your pension after so many years, but you can't collect it until you reach retirement age. Right, so
67, 62, 65.
Let's say 65, 64. But I mean, I know people in state government who retired at the age of 50.
And they're getting some.
And so from the day of their 50 plus one, they're getting their full benefits for the rest of their life. I would say you can qualify, but you can't collect retirement until you're of a retirement age. Can we do that?
And you can go in and crack open the Constitution and do that. But I think the sentiment that Steve's talking about, that it just is wrong. This concept that we would go in and that's the fix. It was the Constitution's fault that we promised you this stuff. It doesn't sit well to me. And I don't mean, you know, from a Democrat or Republican side. It's just as a citizen, as someone who if you signed up for a deal and you took maybe less money to be in a city job or a state job with the promise that at the end of your life that money will come back to you.
I mean,
you can't switch it, man.
What if you took the job because it's got a great pension?
That's
program?
What a lot of people. Well, right? I guarantee you, they said that I would not get the money in the. I'd make more money in the private sector. Say you're working for the state's attorney's office, you'd make a lot more money in a career in the private sector. You're not, but you get great benefits and vacation schedules.
That's how they attracted people to work in
people.
Government. Yeah. That was it. But now, obviously, things have changed, and moving forward, you need to write the laws differently.
Do you think that your Social Security is going to be there as was originally promised?
I
do too. but I'm not. I'm trying to not count on it.
100%. It will absolutely be there.
You think so? Because of the political ramifications for somebody
because it was a promise made and it's just too big to. It's
and
not
they're taking
go
my money
away.
Right now.
Right.
Okay. I mean, that's the thing. I better get it back.
One other topic. Just speaking of cracking open the Constitution, though, my friend Jefferson says that the Constitution should be torn up every 23 years anyway.
And if you wanted to, you could pull back some of those powers and return to legislative supremacy, or tear up the Constitution and start fresh.
I agree with that.
So I'm not alarmed by the idea that you seem to be about going in and busting this thing open.
Let me put it this way. I'm not alarmed about going in and breaking into the Constitution, changing how we tax our citizens in the state
of
Illinois.
Or have gun laws or any laws that we have.
The issue I have is under false pretenses. To go in and say, I'm doing it for a graduated tax. We've opened up the I'm here. Why don't we check the brakes? While we're here, that's the part that I think if you are going to be upfront and honest and you want to sell the public on a change to how we do pensions, then do that and introduce the bill. And I think that's the way it will work. I don't think there's any way that Governor Pritzker could go in there and say, while we're in here, I'm going to tinker. That will start a coup in this state.
But if you had a constitutional convention at the national level or the state level, it would be, I think, helpful. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe impossible. But wouldn't it be nice if we'd say, that was written 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
Sure.
Better that we just amend it, start all over again, and make it comply to the way we live now.
Right. This is I think the one we have now is from the late 60s.
Yeah.
Is that it?
1969.
Go in and change it. Make a constitutional convention. Do the whole thing. But just be upfront about what you're changing.
I didn't realize that, Patty. It was the 60s that we...
It was the late 60s. Yeah. And actually, Speaker Madigan was part of that constitutional convention.
Well, then we should absolutely tear it up and start all over again.
Can't touch it.
I want to talk... nobody else has anything to say about sports wagering or pot, though, right? I mean, we're all on board that generally.
I mean, I think
generally.
That it's going to happen.
Right. I agree.
I have a question for the minds in the room on that, real quick. You saw Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle be asked about legalizing pot in the city of Chicago. I got this question the other day, and I didn't have the answer. That's a state issue. So wouldn't it be a state issue that down in Springfield, if they support it, if J.B. Pritzker is going to do it? Because what is the city's involvement in legalizing marijuana?
We also had it on the ballot as a referendum asking if we supported it. And I think if the funding went to mental health in our communities was part of the question.
Yeah, I love that.
The only way that I'm into
that in front of you.
The only way I'm into legalizing marijuana is if they do what they did in California. And it looks like they're going to do it here. But this idea that you look at the social justice part of it for the people that are in jail right now for small quantities of marijuana, that needs to be fixed. That needs to be rectified. They need to get reparations a whole bit. If you're going to legalize something and then try and keep them in jail, I'm not for that.
That could be, and I'm sorry to say, John, the tragedy of the Jussie Smollett case, because that was Kim Fox. Mm-hmm. You know, Kim Fox was proposing that, and now she's sort of persona non grata. We'll see if she can come back and has still have the clout to do that.
Well, this is sort of the reverse of the grandfathering clause you talked about. Those people broke a law at that time and went to jail for it. The law changed, and you're saying, oh, well, now we should let them out because the law changed. Do you understand the analogy between...
I'm saying
that we ought to be able to do something akin to that to pensioners. We say, well, those were the rules, but we've changed the rules. Now it's reasonable that we ask you to forego some of that.
In the marijuana case, though, you are giving something to someone. In the pension case, you're taking it away from them.
So you would leave those people in jail or you'd let them out?
I'd let them out for minor offenses. Yeah. And I think that even though they might have broken the law, it was bad policy at the time, too.
Yeah. Chicago-based developers at Sterling Bay plan to turn attractive, valuable real estate in Chicago into a $6 billion, 14.5 million square foot office, residential, hotel space. There's another project west of Soldier Field called the 78 with similar issues, but let's just talk about Lincoln Yards for a minute. There would be retail and entertainment venues. There'd be up to 6,000 homes, 600 now, which would be designated as affordable, whatever that means. $490 million in infrastructure funding has already been approved, and they'd need another $400 million in bridge, road, and public transportation. Sterling Bay will pay just under $300 million for improvements. Maybe the most important number is this, though. As the Tribune editorial says, $1.3 billion of taxpayer money that would otherwise go to Chicago Public Schools and other taxing bodies is essentially going to go to this private concern. So we spend $1.3 to get the six.
We spent $1.3 on roads that we're going to drive on and bridges that need to be fixed. I mean, it's not like it's going to anyone's pocket. This is for road repairs, rerouting, and infrastructure that will be publicly accessed.
For a dead space right now. Basically,
right. I mean, you can argue against it, but it's not like it's going into their pockets.
I just feel like we're getting to this point where the only way the developers, like everybody else in this world, are getting to a point where they're like, we can make money, or we can make money. You know what I mean? Like it's not anymore. And so these mega developments, the 78 and Lincoln Yards, you're talking about completely changing the way our city works. And the Lincoln Yards, you're talking about I think it's two or three 60-story, 50-story buildings along the Chicago River. There are no, the highest building, like tallest building in, on the north side of Chicago right now in that vicinity is where the Roby Hotel is at North Damon in Milwaukee. Now, that's that old kind of corner building right there. Okay, that's a small building.
Go along with a great rooftop bar, I might add.
Sure. Nice. But imagine that's 14 stories, and maybe, eight.
And has an unobstructed view eastward to the city. It's amazing.
I'm telling you, like, it just.
What do you order?
Manhattan.
So my idea that's the Finkelsteel is what this is all about. You remember that, the steel plant there?
Yeah, Blagojevich had his party there.
This is that space. And there's been a lot of talk about what to put there. And the plan that came forward is a plan to mega-size and completely build a city that could be its own city somewhere. I don't know why it's got to be that big.
I love the tag for it, Steve. Schomburg Yards. They're going to Schomburgize a valuable tract of real estate in Chicago.
I'm disappointed in you, Justin. I really am. Because I think, you know, I'm sick and tired of the city not doing big things.
We do tons of big things. Look around you.
Make no small plans.
Make no small plans. Thank you, Daniel Burnham.
At what expense?
Well, you tell me. What's the expense? What's the cost?
The expense right now is beyond the $1.3 billion.
We're going to lose the hideout?
No. But there is something to be said about the communities that are just east and west of there. And you talk about Bucktown, Wicker Park to the north. You have Lakeview to the Lincoln Park to the west, to the east. Those communities will change because of the influx of people. I think they're talking 60,000 or so people that would be employed and living in that area. You've got, think about the Kennedy that comes in
there.
What
do you want to go there? So what do you want?
Manageable and what I consider to be smaller development.
How do you compare Wicker Park today to what it was 20 years ago? It's completely transformed.
Absolutely. But to me, it stayed in the fabric of the neighborhood.
Not if you lived there, I bet.
No, but if you had a house at on Winchester and you got that house and someone developer came in and bought it, they built another house on top of it. They didn't build a 40-story new building. And what I'm saying is it might change the architecture of the neighborhood. You might have these beautiful glass million-dollar homes and million-dollar families gentrifying the neighborhood, and that's fine. And there's problems with that as well. But we're talking about a massive, massive change to the north side of Chicago. And I feel like there's a lot of questions still that haven't been answered and a lot of backroom deals. Yep. And I'm a little bit disappointed that I don't know more about
them. What are you thinking?
No, I'm just wondering what other plans were proposed before that. Will we ever know? Were there any smaller ideas? But I don't know. That's a foregone conclusion. This is the direction we're going.
They were
going
to put a ping pong bar in there.
I have no idea. Yeah. I mean, what were the other proposals for that? You know,
I want to get your take, Patty, too, just on the political side of this, because this was a huge campaign issue. It was asked everywhere they went, Tony Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot. Lori Lightfoot, on the record, opposed this, said she wants to make sure that this is taxpayer money.
And she stood on that for 48
she stood
hours.
She even delayed the vote. She turned around yesterday and said, I'm good with it. I got my concessions. We're good to go.
What happened there?
What happened?
I don't know.
Weren't there some concessions?
Yes, there were.
They increased the number of DBEs, disadvantaged businesses.
Yeah, they did.
But it makes me wonder how much more would have been available. I mean, how much more they were willing to give. She got that pretty fast.
I want this to happen. Okay. I was in London in October. They have a canary. There's a whole second downtown that has been rebuilt in 20 years.
The Wharf, Canary Wharf.
The dog. There's another name for it, too. But anyway, and it would be like this, you know, in this great growth and development. I want to see this city doing big things. So I was discouraged when the Finance Committee held up the vote on Monday. But looks like she caved, or I don't quite know what happened.
The political strategy?
She flexed her muscle to get a delay and then...
And then behind closed doors with Sterling Bay and Rahm Emanuel.
And then got it going again.
Well,
I think I'm glad she did, but I don't quite understand it.
She's not even the mayor right now. Moments after becoming the mayor-elect, she was asked to, you know, harness a tornado. It's quite possible she just got it wrong. Literally, she turns it over to her floor captain and says, okay, in 48 hours, that'll be enough time for us to hear both sides. I was surprised by that.
I just wonder. I wonder if it's political strategy, because you want to be a winner. And... they had the votes. So if Lori Lightfoot says, I want to delay this, and they go ahead and the aldermen say, you're not my boss,
right?
And they push this through, you start your tenure weak. You start your tenure where a city council essentially flipped you off. And the question is that what she was looking at? Like, I can't look weak. This is going to go through, almost like with Rahm Emanuel in the parking deal, where he's just like, right, it's not my deal, but I can make it better. And he didn't really make it better. And it's but now it's, you know, he fixed it.
Do you also think it gives her some cover to say, well, this was something that was, you know, in case anything goes sideways, you can say, well, mayor, this is under Mayor Emanuel. The city council was going
to
do this anyway.
But she attached her name to it by doing this, by saying, I'm okay with it. Now it's her project.
But it's so much,
I think he played her.
But it's better, you know, by giving her the delay, and then because she said she wanted a listening hearing on Monday, she got it. Now we vote. But it's so much better that there's a mayor on board with the project rather than dragging her heels with the project, because if it's going to go forward, I just want it to be roses and sunshine.
I guess the question I have for her, I guess for Chicago politics, is can you name who her constituency is? Because I assumed Lori Lightfoot ran on a progressive mantle, and there were a lot of progressives that said she doesn't represent me.
You're really upset that she's in bed with big business.
My issue, though, is that she ran on and she got a lot of support on the lakefront and in the north side of Chicago of being a progressive who wasn't going to kowtow to the interests of City Hall. We're going to sweep it out. We're going to keep these developers accountable. We're going to change the way we do business. And her first thing she does, she goes, I got a little bit more affordable housing. I'm good to go. Pat O'Connor, my friend, Rahm Emanuel, my buddy, give me a hug.
But she might have gotten nothing too, because they might have done it without her.
I would have been okay with that if I voted for Lori Lightfoot and she stood firm, and right before her tenure, Rahm Emanuel tried a little sneaky move to
make this happen.
You would say, okay, she's right. Now she can sweep these guys out. Look, they just tried this in the middle of the night. They tried to.
They did it with the middle of the night.
You've got somebody here who wants to put billions of dollars of private capital into the city. This sounds a little bit, but less to me, like what happened at Wrigley Field. Or I'm trying to think of other areas in Chicago where somebody wants to put private dollars in, and you might not like what it's going to do to River North or Wrigleyville or whatever, but it's private dollars going in, and at some point we'll learn to live with it. We'll be okay with a 50-story building a little bit west of Chicago.
But it's $1.3 billion in infrastructure.
I thought that's what this conversation was going to be about.
That's
more
crazy.
About the fact that those TIFs, this $1.3 billion, were originally conceived to help blighted areas, help spur development where it might not otherwise happen.
Again, Lori Lightfoot ran on the idea of TIF reform, and here we are.
This is going to happen either way.
Yeah,
was going to go in there.
With no adjustments on the TIFs, I think that's a problem, too. And you're right. That was something that she ran on, and I talked about how possibly, you know, considering getting rid of that.
My concern was that it was going to turn into an Amazon HQ2 thing, that the new administration was going to come in and look like they were so leftist and progressive that they were going to thumb their nose at a big development in the city. I think that would have had long-term damage for the city.
I think Sterling Bay wouldn't have run away the same way Amazon did. That's just my impression.
You think they would have downsized it? Which is what you wondered about.
Right. I wonder how much more was left there to give.
Why do we need $1.3 billion in taxpayers' money? Because you want to build the biggest development in the history of development, because you want to make so much money.
Have you ever tried to drive east-west on Armitage?
Absolutely.
It's very difficult.
It's very difficult.
Man. You know,
it's going to be difficult for 15 years now when it goes to one lane.
And afterwards, I mean, that's one thing.
Yeah.
The density in some of these neighborhoods is getting away from us. And my friends who've lived longer in Wrigleyville complain about that. Now, I'm new there, so I'm used to it. They go, it didn't used to be like this. It doesn't have to be this way. Who is it that's running for president now? A governor's doing all the talk show hosts. Governor, this reminds me a little bit of this. He says, I'm getting tired of seeing companies hold cities and states hostage, right? If you don't give us everything we want, as you said, not money, a lot of money, then we're going to go somewhere else, and you will be sorry for that. And so that's how you get Minnesota to build stadiums for billionaires. That's what happens in Chicago, too. I don't remember what we did for Boeing, but it struck me as a pretty generous concession to give Boeing.
We did it for Soldier Field.
Jay Inslee, I think you're thinking of in Washington.
Inslee, yeah. Governor Inslee. Thank you, Elif. And I just love to hear him say that. I'm like, you know, that happened. I don't know how you even fix that, because as soon as somebody says, okay, then we won't build the billionaire stadium, Los Angeles says, we'll take another football team, or Las Vegas wants a football team, and they will. So they play one against the other. And he had some idea about how you federally prohibit that through the tax code. I don't know what that is. I don't know if he knows what it is.
Well, we saw it with the headquarters debate. Dave McKinney is a great reporter. He's at BEC now. Did a whole thing, and he reminded us of Sears. And he did a piece about Sears was one of Motorola. These companies, there is a long history of us giving a lot of tax incentive and taxpayer money to these corporations to build these mega things. And then in 10 years, they're like, you know what? We're going to do something else. But there is something about how much are we on the hook as taxpayers to help corporations make money. And that, and I also think the other political story, which I have not heard enough about, 31 aldermen voted for Lincoln Yards. The aldermen that were next to those spaces, and this would be Wagaspak in Bucktown, Michelle Smith on your side, they voted no. So there are 31 aldermen that said, this is good for the city of Chicago. It's not my ward. I don't care. And a lot of them, predominantly the ones who were bent out of shape that there was even opposition, were South and West Side black aldermen who said, this is good for my communities because we're going to get hired. There's going to be jobs for people who live in the 28th ward.
What about
the 20th ward?
Wait a minute.
I just feel
You just cited two neighboring aldermen. You didn't cite the alderman.
Alderman Hopkins.
And Hopkins liked it.
Hopkins made it happen.
But he's a very progressive guy too, who might have been opposed to it no matter where it was.
Steve, I can't, and this is out there. They redistricted Wagaspak out of that area 5 years ago after the last the deal right before I think it was right before Emanuel or after Emanuel. They redistricted the wards. Remember, Bob Fioretti got bounced; he didn't have a ward anymore.
Right.
They did that for Lincoln Yards, and I know that sounds crazy conspiracy theory, but that's how far they look ahead. Crazy.
Patty,
and
I want you to get an herbal
and then Brian
tea
Hopkins
for my
got
friend.
Here. I'm out of here.
He's
going to buy the first condo.
yeah, that's right. If you have a condo
anyway,
in that
I want to know the deal that was made, just like the book Boss back in the day.
Okay.
What deal was made to get the South Side and West Side aldermen on board and emphatic about this Lincoln Yard?
Speaking of conspiracy theories, Attorney General William Barr says he's curious to see if the FBI did, in fact, spy on the Trump campaign. Now, that's the way I put it. Do you put it that way?
No, I don't. I do not put it that way. He said there was spying on a presidential campaign.
I think spying on a political campaign is a big deal.
You can find a soundbite to support you, but it came about 20 minutes later.
Well, they asked him about it again. They said, Mr. Barr, he said, we're curious about the language you're using. That raises alarm bells when you use that kind of verbiage.
And he said...
And it is my understanding...
I'm not suggesting that those rules were violated, but I think it's important to look at that.
He said that eventually, but at first he said, yeah, there was spying, and there was a female, it was a woman senator, it was Shaheen, I think, from New Hampshire, and she said, do you mean to say that? He goes, well, there was spying on a presidential campaign. I take that important. He said, and we have to look upon what it was predicated and see if it was justified spying. John, the CIA is in charge of spying. I promise you, no director of the CIA has ever testified before the Congress that they spy.
Right.
That to use that word was so dismaying to me because it was investigation, it was surveillance, it was whatever. He chose to use the word spy.
Why did he do that?
Because he wanted, I don't know. I really don't know. Because
he wanted to give the president something to tweet.
I want to have faith in this guy, but he bought right into the Donald Trump's, someone said yesterday he traded in
his talking point.
He traded in his tortoise shell glasses for a tinfoil hat.
I think Nancy Pelosi put it well when she said, you're not the attorney general for the president, you're the attorney general for the people of the United States. But this, he's acting like a personal, he's acting like...
But think of that, with my example, the CIA doesn't say they spy. You know, they don't say we're spies. That is such a pejorative term and word. And for the attorney general...
The word
general
spy bothers you? Or the fact that they do or don't admit that they
no,
do
that
it?
They use the word spy. Because he's talking about the FBI agents who work under him, the deputy attorney general who works under him and signed off on this stuff. And he said there was spying on the presidential campaign. Now I want to see if it's justified. No one's going to hear that. And I just think he deliberately, and the senators from both parties, I'm playing the part of Justin on this issue.
No, I like it.
But the senators from both parties invited him to walk that back, and he didn't do it.
So you're not suggesting, though, that spying occurred?
I don't, I guess you could, I think there was a spying did occur.
And it's just so discouraging.
But is the issue in this? The issue is not spying. The issue is whether or not it was created on false pretenses, right?
Right. Yeah. And let's go back to that those days when they were quote unquote well, I'm not going to say it, when they were investigating Trump. We did not know about it. These were the months and weeks before the election. We sure as hell knew about the Hillary Clinton one. Everyone was talking about that.
Thanks, Comey.
If the point of this was to do in Donald Trump, why the hell did the people who wanted to do in Donald Trump keep it so damn secret?
Right.
There was no conspiracy to get rid of Donald Trump then.
So we don't disagree that the federal government was listening in on or investigating the Trump campaign.
I think that's been pretty widely reported, yeah.
Okay, right. Because they had an interest to see whether or not there was any sort of cooperation with the Russians, right?
Right.
I mean, that's why they were doing it.
And why did they start that? Because they had... The Greek was drunk in London with George Papadopoulos.
Yes.
I mean, that's how it started. It wasn't from some eavesdropping. It was from a drunk in London.
And I think the talking points go beyond spying. You see, now President Trump is talking about this being illegal.
Right.
A legal investigation. They tried, this isn't a coup, attempted coup.
He wants to go back to the oranges of it.
It really does. It feels like this is a coordinated, these are the words we're going to use. And then, because when this Mueller report comes out and then people can pick it apart and be interpretive about it, he's going to be like, oh no, it's a
over.
Coup. It's illegal.
It is over. When Barr released the 4-page memo saying exonerated, and then he talks here about spying on the Trump campaign, it doesn't matter anymore what Robert Mueller says. It's been ingested by the American people. It's over.
Right. You undermine the validity of our justice system.
He was allowed to frame it in a way that works for Trump.
It really is a classic case where he's doing it in broad daylight. You see him, you know what he's doing. He's telling you something that's not true or is advantageous to him. And if you just say it over and over and over and over and over again, it kind of works. We know that's happening, and yet here it's happening right before us. It does seem to be accomplishing that end. Should Lori Loughlin go to jail?
Sure.
How long should she go to jail?
Martha Stewart went to jail for, you know,
Martha Stewart didn't go to jail for what she did. She went to jail for lying about what she did.
Yeah.
I don't know where Loughlin is on that continuum, but let's just say for laundering money and bribing somebody for $500,000 to get her kids into school, should she go to jail for that?
Yeah.
And for how long should she go to jail?
I don't know. I heard you talking about this yesterday. Wasn't it 4 to 6 months is what they're saying for Felicity Huffman?
That was Felicity Huffman.
Right.
But they're...
4 to 6 years or was it just months?
4 to 10 months for Huffman, maybe.
Okay.
That was recommended. And then,
but new charges.
I think that's insane, too. I absolutely think that any of these rich people going to jail... is a waste of our tax dollars.
Well, they'll just keep doing it. I mean,
they will. No,
the
their kids
point...
are. Their kids are. They're going to put them back in school.
Not them. I mean, the rich people who want to get away with this. We
well, find the hell. Find the hell out of them.
That's what I say.
I mean,
they don't care. If they cared about being fined, they wouldn't have done this in the first place.
I don't know. Maybe the next person.
If there's a threat of prison, then perhaps we. You know,
there was John. I shared with you. Do you have the numbers?
Harvard has roughly a 6% average acceptance rate. You know, very very low. Incredibly selective. If you were a legacy, i.e. had a close relative who went to Harvard, your chances of getting into Harvard rose to 34%, from 6 to 34.
Yeah.
If you were on something called the Dean and Director's Interest List, which means you are rich or you are famous, your chances of getting into Harvard go up to 42%. If you are one of the relatively small number of kids who apply who's the child of a faculty or staff member at Harvard, you have a 47% chance of getting in. And if you are a recruited athlete, the number is 86%.
The outrage here is because somehow these celebrities and rich people infiltrated a fair system. Well, it's not a fair system. It's never been a fair system. Much more likely than the general population if you're a legacy to get in. Even more likely if you're a relative of a professor to get in. There also is this preferred dean's list that allows their favorites to get in. Far more likely to get in than the general populace who's applying. So the system is already...
And the highest
group, the
greatest probability are athletes who are recruited. 80% of the athletes who are recruited get in, I guess, somewhat regardless of their academics.
So the system is cooked. It's a cooked system. And so sending Lori Loughlin to jail... I mean, I don't have sympathy for them, but I'm not as outraged by it because it's all stacked.
It's all rigged. I just don't understand. I don't know how that pertains to someone breaking the law or gives them permission to do so. I just don't understand how when someone breaks the law, you know, it commits a crime, white collar crime or otherwise.
Well, in Chicago, we just pretend it didn't. We do 2 days of community service.
Is it because they did it for their kids that were like, oh, you know, well, they just wanted the best for their kids? I'm not sure.
I don't think Jussie Smollett should have gone to jail either. I think he should have paid a big fine. I think that Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin and all those people should pay a substantive deterring fine in the future that can be used to
no jail. Jail, yes or no?
Sure. If that's what the sentencing guidelines are,
then you're okay with them going
okay
to the clink.
I'm
How about
okay
you, sir?
Money laundering. I mean, that's a thing that's on the books.
racketeering.
Well, if it's just about getting her kids, you're like, oh, no, good job. But yeah, if you broke the law in wire transfers and otherwise,
I have the ability to make
the
distinction between what you racketeer.
Yeah.
Some racketeering, I think, all racketeering bad, some racketeering worse. So if you're racketeering and it's so stupid and so personal and nobody else is injured by your racketeering other than the proverbial theoretical student who also didn't get in, who I'm not real worried about,
right.
Then I'm not that exercised by the crime. I mean, fine the hell out of them. They've got the money. And let that be the shot across the bow to future rich parents who want to cheat to get their kids into school. I think it should be transparent anyway. I think if you want to pay $1 million and your kid gets into school, don't pay it to a bookie or a broker. Pay it to the school. Just say he got C's, but we're famous. Here's $1 million, and then let him in. I actually do not see the harm in that. Now, it might devalue the academic prestige of that school. That's a calculation the school needs to make.
I thought that was happening already.
Yeah,
I really did. Yeah. That's why I was like, why didn't you just pay the school?
Yeah,
we're out of time.
Noah Assange and his dirty cat in the embassy and stuff like that.
I had to read about Julian Assange for this, and then we didn't talk about it. It's okay.
This will be the 30 seconds. Your thoughts on the Julian Assange thing. You get 30 seconds. Go.
Conflicted. I am one of these people who say I think he does good in the sense that there are a lot of secrets and things behind closed doors that the governments don't want us to see because they will show that the governments are doing bad. And so I'm a little conflicted. I think there's a lot of things that dude is a conflicted anti-hero. I don't like the guy, but I don't think that he should be extradited because he let us know about civilian kills in Afghanistan.
Time's up.
Well, and the sexual assault charges, which have already been dropped, were an issue as well for me. I mean, I know a lot of people look at him as an anti-hero. I never really thought much about it except that he has something to answer for.
At how much coverage this, how intensely interested people seem to be. The big vision of them dragging him out. He looks like a bad version of David Letterman now. They're dragging him out of that embassy or hotel and taking him into a van, driving him away to who knows where. He did not look well. Is that your 30 seconds that you wanted to use?
No.
Ready, set, go.
Oh, my recommendation is to read the book Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story by Matt Balaker. And I interviewed the author this week. I had the pleasure of working with Greg Giraldo early in my career. And for some reason, the universe often put him in front of me to remind me of why I should stay the course of my career, and a career that knocked me down many times. We lost him when he was only 44 years old in 2010. And that's a beautiful book about an incredible career.
Mm. Listen to the podcast of that interview. I heard it live on the air. And when you did a performance and then he came out and found you and talked about that.
Oh, Last Comic Standing. Yeah, I ate it for a laugh because I talk very fast and you only have 2 minutes. And he actually destroyed the comic in front of me, criticized him mercilessly. Butch Bradley called him a hack. Butch had only gotten 28 seconds into his act. I got the whole 2 minutes. But he came out. It was the last time I saw Greg. He came out and followed me to my car and leaned against the car. And I remember thinking he didn't look great. He looked a little ashen and had lost a lot of weight, and he was just shaking his head. And I had done material about my son Declan, about Declan having autism. He goes, you know, we saw 400 comics this week, but they're going to remember that there were 7 moms who had sick kids, and you fell into that list. And he goes, they just didn't want to hear it. But we sat outside and talked, and it was the last time. I hate Last Comic Standing, but I love that I got to see him one more time.
Well, there is a line in that interview you did where one of them said to you, "You are one of the you're like the 7th best." You are the 7th best comic, female comic in America today.
He said, in 1999, Greg Giraldo said, he had seen me 2 years earlier and thought I was terrible, that I was never going to make it. He saw me at Gotham in New York, and he said, you were one of those, am I right, ladies, kind of comics. And he said, two years later, he said, you're in the top 7 of all female comics in the country, which told me exactly where I was in the list, because I wasn't in the top 5, but I wasn't 8, 9, or 10. So, yes, I was either 6 or 7.
So, and the other comic doing the studio, that's a life of a comic. Somebody pays you that kind of a compliment, you
absolutely
go, well,
take
who's
it.
Number 6? Because
I know, right?
I live a life of insecurity.
Yeah.
So my 30 seconds goes this way. Two numbers that I just thought would be fun to share with you, 23 and 253. 23 and 253. If there are 23 people in a room, 2 of them have the same birthday.
That's the number. You have a 50-50 chance. If there's 23 people in the room, the two of them will share a birthday. But you need 253 people in the room for someone to share your birthday. Just a couple of fun numbers I thought I'd share at the end of today's podcast.
My brain hurts now.
Okay, thank you, Patty Vasquez. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. Justin.
Thank you.
We're produced by Olive Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.